It's easy to be somebody, but it's hard to disappear. Let's face it, everybody, sometimes you just want to be by yourself. That's when I slip off in the evening with some ice cold beer. Just me, myself, and I, nobody else.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Robert Earl Keane started playing music as a student at Texas A&M, picking and singing on his front porch with his buddy Lyle Lovett. He became known for Americana classics like The Road Goes On Forever and Merry Christmas from the Family, but he was especially beloved for his live shows. He spent some 40 years on the road, and then last September, he retired as a touring act. But he hasn't retired from making music. He's got a new record out called Western Chill, and it's quite a package. A double album, a live DVD, a songbook so people can play along, and a graphic novel that tells the story of a wandering troubadour, much like Keane himself. Robert talked to me about how Western Chill came about, the disasters in his final tour, and the place where he goes when it's time to write more songs. If you listen to his music, you know Robert Earl Keane is a hell of a storyteller. In my first couple of questions, you'll also hear my neighbor's lawnmower in the background. That is the magic of being on Zoom and outside the studio in 2023. Here's our conversation. There's no reason you would remember this, but I interviewed you like 30 years ago when you were coming through Charlotte on tour. I don't remember much of it either, but the one thing I do remember is that the interview was like 3 p.m. or something, and I woke you up.
Well, that's not a surprise.
And I'm wondering, you know, tour musicians, obviously, they're on second shift at best.
Sure.
And I'm wondering now that you've been off the road for a while, if your body clock has changed.
Nope. Not at all. I for some reason I have I've actually regressed to the point where back then, you know, it was like, you know, go to bed at, I don't know, 2 or 1:30 sometime. And over the last summer, the tour was so rigorous that it was rare when I actually went to bed by 3 or 4, and somehow I haven't been able to get off of that schedule, which is kind of maddening for, well, everybody around me, and then even to some extent me, because I keep thinking, well, you know, I'm going to be able to get back on a regular schedule and be a normal human being. But the, you know, the problem therein lies the part where it says normal human being. So I'm kind of stuck with this for the time being. I do have glimpses of a normal life occasionally, but still, in general, I'm up till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
That you mentioned that last tour being rigorous, it feels like it was a lot more than that. It feels like it sounded like just this like series of calamities. Could you tell folks sort of what all happened to you and everybody around you?
I made this announcement about retiring in on the 14th of January in 2022, and about a week later we went on a short tour of the southeast. I remember we were in Bristol and some of those places in that area, the Tennessee and North Carolina area. Everything was just great, and I have all these videos, and there was some snow here and there. The weather was really great in the January, just beautiful, and I was interviewing people, and I had this big thing all figured out, like, you know, how I was going to keep up with it the entire time. And so we took a break in mid-February, came back in March, and March, I believe it was like the 7th of March, we were in Beaver Creek, Colorado, playing a show at the Valour Center, which is a beautiful venue. And I was walking across the driveway to get ready to go do the show and get back to the green room. And my back just completely went out on me, and I hit the cement, and I had to find somebody there around Beaver Creek to give me some kind of shot to get through the show. So they gave me some kind of non-narcotic steroidal shot that was supposed to last 36 hours. And that's exactly how long it lasted. And I could walk for about 36 hours. And after that, it was truly one oddball. By that time, that was probably mid-April. I had so many problems that I decided that somebody put some kind of curse on me. So what validated my curse thing was, all of a sudden, the day that we were doing our Austin City Limits recording to do like the sixth Austin City Limits thing that I'd recorded, that day I had these two big crosses that popped up on my forearm and the inside of my arm that were just like, you know, full blown religious crosses,
like some sort of like arm. Weird stigmata.
Yeah. yes. And then I started going, see, I told you I'm cursed here. And after that, it was, you know, if it wasn't my back, it was just some kind of incredible, like just depletion of energy, and I couldn't move for a couple of days. And we got back on the road, and it just, anytime that I was off the road, I was going to see some doctor about either my back or my leg or my feet fell apart. I had a bus driver just tell me one day that he was going to be gone for the next 3 weeks out of nowhere. And that was like a shock. And I had to scramble to get another bus driver, and there were, you know, some problems with the band and just some personnel problems. And in July, like the 19th, we were in New York City playing at Irving Plaza, and I woke up and I had Bell's palsy.
Man.
And my face completely just, you know, just went slack on my left side. And after that, we were coming back, I think it was in early August, we were coming back from New Orleans and pulled over in a place called Gonzales, Louisiana. The bus driver that I had to get to sub for the other guy pulled over, fortunately for us, and they opened up the back of the bus and it just blew into flames. And there's pictures. So we all got out and just watched the bus just like burn all the back into the whole engine of the bus in the back, just burn up. But fortunately, the Gonzales Police Department and Fire Department and the EMS all showed up and they put the fire out. Fortunately, I mean, it did not burn up the whole cabin, because if it had even gotten in, it did get into the cabin somewhat because I was in the very back. And it started smoking through the doors of the little cabinets there right as I was walking out. And I thought, oh, my God, this really is on fire. And so after that, it was just catch as catch can for the rest of the rest until the September the 4th, which was the last official show that we played.
Now, I read somewhere that you along the way as all this was happening, you got tried to get some voodoo assistance?
Well, when I was in New Orleans, I was still convinced that I was under some great big curse. So I went in there and bought $400 worth of keep evil spirits away, kind of voodoo stuff. And I had the most unsalesmanlike young lady that I've ever talked to. She just was as blank as you possibly get. And I said, well, does this work? She says, sir, it all works. And I was like, okay, but I mean, will this protect me from my curse and my evil spirit? She says, I'm sure it will if you do it correctly. I said, well, how do I do it correctly? She says, read the directions. So I said, okay, fine. So I had all these candles going, and that was the very same day. It was like the very day I bought all the voodoo stuff. The bus got on fire. So it didn't appear to work. Well, I claim that it kept the fire from coming into the cabin and burning us all up. But nobody will side with me on that argument at all.
When you woke up the morning after that last concert, mm-hmm. what did that feel like to you?
Well, that, you know, it's like somebody opened the door and you have an incredible whole new horizon in front of you. And as exciting as that can be, at the same time, there's a little bit of fear about what the hell am I going to do now? And I made the right decision. I feel like I made exactly the right decision. I feel like I gave it my best. We were able to put together shows across the U.S. where we got to go to almost all the places that we have some popularity and people could see us. And we got to play in some, venues that I'd never gotten to play before because, there was, a lot of interest in coming to these shows. So I did a lot of things that, were on my, wish list or just that I always thought about that would be great. And because we did that last year, there was still some space based on, the long tail of COVID that still was working somewhat in 22. And now that's pretty much gone. Had I tried to do that this year, this is going to be the biggest touring year ever, probably. I mean, historically, it will be the biggest touring year up to this point anyway. So there's everybody's out there. Everybody put records out in April. There was just a glut of records put out. And that was all, April's not always a popular time to put records out, but the whole thing was to get your record out and then follow it up with these big tours. So these big tours are out there. I mean, they're, like Springsteen is touring again, that kind of thing. And Taylor Swift is like putting on the, I don't know what, three shows a day or something, something crazy. It would have been very difficult to get some of the venues and some of the, actually just the interest at all.
Yeah. I was thinking about along those lines about whether you feel like getting off the road is a more addition or subtraction. And what I mean is more a chance to do things that you've always been wanting to do and hadn't had a chance to do, or is it the ability not to do a lot of things that you didn't want to do anymore?
It hasn't worked out exactly this way, but I would say it really is about the opportunities that present themselves once you get a chance to sit back and decide, I would like to do this and that. When I say that it hadn't worked out exactly like that, because there's been a lot of things that I've spent an inordinate amount of time, organizing. I thought it was organizing my life in 22 and trying to get that together. But I realized as I went along, I've been organizing my entire life. I mean, I've been, books and folders and scrap paper and, songs and all kinds of stuff, and trying to put them all in some kind of organizational way where I can understand it and know what I'm doing. So I've spent a lot of time doing that, and that's taken time away from the idea of just jumping off into a new venture. But I've got new ventures going on, so I'm just doing as much as I can to catch up on all fronts.
Well, this Western Chill, this new package you put out, it's not just a double album. There's a DVD. Mm-hmm. There's a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. There's a songbook if people want to play along. The songs there. Had you been thinking about trying to do something this ambitious before?
No, I didn't. This was, you know, really inspired by the fact that, like, you know, I call, you know, the advent of COVID was March 20th, because that's when I heard it really from the industry people of 2020. And I kept everybody on salary with that, with insurance and stuff like that, because I didn't feel like I could walk away from that. So we made that happen. But after a couple of months and nobody doing anything, you know, I'd call him, what are you doing? I'm doing nothing, you know? So, well, I have a place way out in the country, way away from everyone. And I built this video studio and started getting these guys to come in and we would rehearse. And first it was just kind of like a picking party, you know, like just hang out and play. But as we went along, we, you know, there was this new kind of bonding and rehearsal kind of thought that we really never had jumped into wholeheartedly before. And so from that, I, you know, I wrote a bunch of these songs, and then I told these guys that I wanted to make a you know, do some kind of thing, at least do a video of a band inclusive project where we do some of my songs and some of their songs. And so everybody brought these songs together, and miraculously All the songs that they brought really fit the whole vibe and everything that I had been working on. I wrote like four or five songs. I had some other ones that I had written, but I wrote specifically four or five songs for this project. And all the songs that they brought in fit the whole thing. So the whole thing really, I mean, it's, you know, it's called Western Chill, but it's truly a chill vibe and real easy to listen to. And it's not, you know, it's not like, you know, real complicated narratives or any of that kind of business. It's just like really good music played really well. And we shot it as a DVD. And then we decided, you know, let's take it a little further and make it into a record. And then the graphic novel thing popped up and we just kept, yeah, I backed into it ambitiously. There was no real like forward motion to be ambitious about it, but it did become a very ambitious product project. It's hard to explain to people what you're getting, but what I finally come up with is like, you can throw away all your self-help books and get this box set of Western Chill and just totally chill out, because it's like, it's a lifestyle record.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I was thinking, you know, people talk about, you know, you create the art that you want to be in the world and that you need for yourself. Did you feel like as you were doing that you sort of needed to chill?
Absolutely. I you know, sometimes we use music for excitement or some touchstone to a memory or something. And I really was looking just for the vibe.
Well, you got this line pretty early on in the title track saying, it's easy to be somebody, but it's hard to disappear. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, as you were writing that, is that how you might have been feeling at the time?
I do think that had something to do with it. There's no doubt that I was taking it from my perspective, but also I was taking it from how most people want to be somebody, you know, one way or another. And then, you know, it comes down to that, you know, be careful what you wish for kind of thing, because I'm not doing it as a warning in the song. I'm just saying from my perspective, yeah, you can definitely be somebody. It's easier to be somebody than you think it is. You can do all kinds of stuff to get that notoriety or notice, you know, or attention. To walk away from it, that can be like difficult. And so the whole idea there is just, you know, then the rest of the song is what I basically call the prologue to the record. It just sets up the record about how, you know, this is what you do to disappear. You know, you just sit back and take it easy.
Sue was a waitress at the Only John Town. She had a reputation as a girl who'd been around. Down Main Street at the midnight, a brand new pack of cigs, a fresh one hanging from her lips, a beer between her legs. She'd ride down to the river and meet with all her friends. The road goes on forever and the party never ends.
Now, That was Robert Earl Keen's signature song, The Road Goes On Forever, which was also recorded by the Highwaymen, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson, and Johnny Cash. When we come back, Keen talks about when he first decided to become a musician.
I picked up this guitar that my sister had, and I learned how to play a D chord. And as soon as I learned how to play a D chord, it was like, this is all I want to do.
That and more I had on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Robert Earl Keen. So in the graphic novel, the main character, who's not you, but maybe metaphorically you, is goes on a road trip to find inspiration. Do you do that same sort of thing?
Oh yeah. Many times, and I live in a great place as lots of inspiration as far as like being able to write songs, not just the landscape, but the people, the whole thing. I've done that a lot, but there are times when I just like feel like, I have to get out of town. I got to get some kind of new stimulus to really write a really good song. And consequently, I'll have to say, over as many records as I've made, I'd say about half of them, I didn't write half of them somewhere else, but what I did do is like I got a really good song out of like sitting around and writing three or four or five songs. And one of them was like, in my opinion, was really spectacular. And it was something that I would have never gotten just sitting there on my own back porch.
You talked about being at home and what you like there. And I know you've got this place that's famous among your fans called the Scriptorium.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell folks who maybe is not familiar with your career what that is and what it means to you?
Well, the Scriptorium is about this rock building that has like a high pitched roof, and the best way I can describe it is it looks like something say from the 19th century or late 19th century, especially around like the Hill Country area, Fredericksburg. Or where they did a lot of rock work, like not like big flashy rocks. I'm just talking about like almost like just stone, like bricks almost, right? And so it's made like that. And then it's only like 400 or 500 square feet inside. I mean, it's really small, but it has this jail bed that I had this guy build, so you can hook it up against the wall so you have more room and you can just drop it down and all you have is two chains that hold it up. And then when it opens up to an amazing view for like 10 miles because it's sitting on the side of a hill, fire pit there and a little kind of grill thing. And it's just like, for me, because of how old it is and how compact it is, it's a place that, I always, just as soon as I walk in there, I feel great. And when I write songs, especially like specifically for a record or something, I go there and I spend about, a week to 10 days there. And I'd leave my phone at home and I leave the computers at home and I just have books and guitars. And I live on venison sausage and white bread and Big Red, which no one knows outside of Texas what that is. But anyway, and I live on things that you probably shouldn't be living on. And I sit there and I read books till I get tired of that. And then I pick up the guitar and play the guitar for a while. And then I take a nap, and then I start it all over again. And it just goes on. And I found over the years that if you sequester yourself in that situation, there is kind of a metamorphosis that takes a place where you, the first couple of days, you're really excited about being there. But like day three and four, there's this kind of weird transformation about loneliness and being all by yourself and too many thoughts in your head. And you kind of go crazy for a couple of days. I always think of like that, Apocalypse Now thing with Martin Sheen and,
right,
you know, running, banging around in the room, throwing the whiskey bottle on it. There's kind of that going on. And then when you come out of that, I've always felt like there's a certain amount of clarity, and that's where I really can really find some, you know, great, great new angles to write a song, because there's just, I've never been someone who wrote the same kind of song twice. I just keep looking for, I'm not looking for the perfect song. I'm just always looking for a new way to write one.
I've heard sort of the legend about you and your friends, including Lyle Lovett, hanging out on the porch, singing and picking and all that sort of thing back in the 70s there. Were you always back then thinking, this is what I want to do with my life, to be a musician?
I want to say, and I've said this before, but I want to say, as soon as I was able, I didn't play the guitar until my first semester there at A&M. I didn't play an instrument at all. And I got the guitar because it's one of those real lonely places a lot of people have when they first go off to school and things. And I was having that kind of experience. So I picked up this guitar that my sister had, and I learned how to play a D chord. And as soon as I learned how to play a D chord, it was like, this is all I want to do. I just want to go zing, 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 zing. And I did. I mean, I just zing, zing, zing over and over. And I don't think I ever had a real solid, serious thought about doing anything else after that. I mean, I said I did, but none of them were real. They were just like, you know, something to placate my parents or something. You know, it's like, I'm going to go, you know, be a PhD in whatever, rocket science. But I was totally in on that. And also felt like that was the place for me, because I'd written poetry since I was about 8 years old. And when I realized that, you know, I could take that stuff and put it into a song with a guitar, that was like, okay, I got the magic formula now.
You talked about feeling lonely at that beginning of that. Mm-hmm. Picking up that guitar and learning to play, did that ease that loneliness, like internally, in the sense of you had a way to express yourself, or externally, like playing the guitar brought people around and you had new friends?
That was definitely at first it was all internal. It was all, you know, I was just so happy, and I was so happy to be able to, like, you know, put a few chords together and then play a whole song and then learn these songs off a songbook or something like that, or learn a song off the radio. I remember like figuring out, you know, how to play a couple of songs that were, you know, relatively easy songs on them, but I did it on my own, and I was like, oh, I can figure this out. For the longest time, it was totally internal, and I was just really happy to do that. But then I found out, like, oh, I don't have to stand around at parties with my hands in my pocket, you know, thinking, I need to say something clever to this girl. You know, I can sit down and play my guitar. And then there were always people at those kind of parties, you know, that could play. And then you just meet more and more and more musicians as you go along, and it, you know, becomes almost a community thing.
I know at the beginning of your career, you spent a long time kind of struggling. I know you went to Nashville for a while and that didn't work out, and you worked other kinds of jobs and all that sort of thing. Do you remember a moment when you felt like, okay, now I can do this. This is what I can do for a living. I don't have to worry about the other stuff anymore. Was there a moment that sort of a turning point for you?
I had a turning point that it was significant. One weekend in Dallas, I'd been playing at some kind of small places, and you know, barely making enough gas money and all that sort of stuff. And I played at a very famous, venerable music establishment called Poor David's Pub, which was basically, you know, a small club that was kind of had theater seating. And I think it held about 250 or 300. And I went there and I had this guy that was, I was in a cab and I had this guy that was from Nigeria and we were talking about music on the way there. And when I got to Poor David's Pub, there were people literally standing out in the street waiting to get in. And I didn't have any idea that it was going to be popular or not, but it turned out that it was like sold to the gill, it sold out. And when we pulled up, we were talking about how music makes you happy. And when we pulled up, he goes, "This is you?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." He goes, "You must be very happy." And I said, "I am very happy." So that was a really big moment for me right there.
So a lot of people know many, many, many of your songs. I think occasional listeners would know Merry Christmas from The Family and The Road Goes On Forever. Mm-hmm. I've always thought, I'm not a songwriter, but I've always thought if I wanted to like really make it as a songwriter and cash in, writing a Christmas song is a way to do it because it gets played every year. Mm-hmm. And I wonder when you set out to write that song or when you started to write out that song, Did you do it with that idea in mind or did it just kind of come out of nowhere?
I was writing songs for Gringo Honeymoon, and I was in Nashville, and I was staying in this little apartment, and I got, and I had just written a song on Gringo Honeymoon called "The Raven and the Coyote," and it's a long, somewhat convoluted narrative that had a lot of pieces to it, and I remember I was just really grinding on it, and I finished that, and I thought, God, I just got to write some kind of junk here to get this all, just, you know, break the chain here because my head's just about to pop with all these little bits of information. And did I overwork this song, which I probably did, but I started thinking, well, look, I'm supposed to record this pretty soon, but I've got like, this is in November. So I said, I got all, you know, I got the rest of November and I got all of December. And I thought, no, you don't have December because December is Christmas and it's just going to, you're not going to be able to get away. It's just, you know, December, especially in the music business, just might as well just take it off the calendar almost, you know, because nobody's working in the music business. I mean, people are touring, but people aren't working. You can't get anything done. You can't schedule anything. And so I just went, oh my God. And I thought, I know what I'm just going to write my own Christmas song because I'm tired of hearing the same old, I don't even know what a chestnut looks like. Okay. So I'm going to write. So I started writing and then like, I'm having the best time in the world. I'm like laughing at all these lines and having a great time just throwing all this stuff in there. And also actually, you know, I'm sorry, I threw a few people, you know, relatives and stuff under the bus. I mean, by and large, the whole song is absolutely true across the board.
Caught the turkey, turned the ball game on. Mixed margaritas when the eggnog's gone. Send somebody to the quick pack store. We need some ice and an extension cord. A can of bean dip and some Diet Rides. A box of tampons, some Marlboro Lights. Cheese. Merry Christmas from the family.
So I was just throwing it all in and I was having the best time. And then I just put it aside. And when I went to the producer, I played him all the songs that I had written for Gringo Honeymoon, which there's really some great songs on that record. He said, "Well, you got anything else?" That always cracks me up when they say, "You got anything else?" Like you give them like, you know, full blown gold bars and they're still asking for gold dust or something. You know, you're like, I said, "Yeah, I got this kind of stupid song about Christmas, you know." He goes, well, play that for me. So I played it, and he's just howling, laughing, and just loving it. And I went, this is any good? He goes, oh, this is great. This is great. And I was like, okay. I've never been very good at judging my own material. I don't really know what's a hit and what's not a hit. So I was just shocked that he even liked it. And then I was even more shocked because he's like, oh, well, this has got to go on the record. So I was just like, all right, oh, well, whatever, you're the producer. So so we put it on the record, and I got the same reaction from the very beginning, from that guy to the next 10 people I played it for, to the room full of 300 people that I played it for. It always worked exactly. It just works, you know. It speaks to people, you know. It was one of those songs that, you know, had he not even been asking for something else, I might not have ever played it, because I've got a ton of those kind of songs, just like, you know, just they're all on voice memos or something. I got one recently that I forgot what it was called. It was called Old Ground Meat. Okay, I've got stuff like that, right? And then I have Old Ground Meat number two. That's even worse, right?
So at your last show, you gave a speech, and during that speech, one of the things you said was, we are now standing on the precipice of new and exhilarating adventures. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, 8 months after that show, are you feeling that way?
Absolutely. But like I said earlier, I have been somewhat stalled out, catching up on organizing my life, and then also the projects that have come out with Western Chill. When I'm talking about the precipice on exhilarating adventures, what I've been wanting to do, and this is going to happen to some degree, I wanted to get out and, like, you know, share some of my experience with other artists and also help some people sort of avoid some of the really easy trappings or pitfalls in the whole industry that you only know because you've experienced it over and over. And I can see stuff a mile down the road these days when I'm just talking to industry people or something. And I'm not saying that they're out there to trick you, but the fact is there are some places where you can get sidelined or dead-ended and you don't need to be there. And instead of sitting there thinking for 18 months, oh, I need to change my label, or I need to do this and stuff like that, you don't have to sit there and wait. You can figure this out. And I'm not out there to badmouth anybody or anything. What I really want to do is put myself in a place. And I'm, like I said, I'm going to have this opportunity where I can really help somebody, because we can't all be, we can't all be Justin Bieber. We can't, a lot of people have these aspirations where they want to be like the highest level, but there are so many places in the music business and in the entertainment business where you can really do well and really enjoy your life. I feel like I really enjoyed my life, and I didn't like hit the major spots. Some people achieve and feel good about. I just feel good about the fact that I was able to do pretty much everything I wanted to do at one time or another.
You've often talked about your early dreams of being a cowboy. Mm-hmm. And I know at your last show, you brought your favorite rodeo guy of all time up on stage with you. Do you feel like there's any parallels between the cowboy life and the life that you ended up having?
I would say, in that, like, I'm definitely, riding. I rode herd over a band for that many years. And, like that novel, I think it's Edward Abbey or something. Lonely Are the Brave, you know, it's like about this cowboy kind of gets off the track and stuff. And I feel like that there's a lot of parallels in that way, in that and sometimes it's a lonely existence, but the highs are always better than the lows.
Pack my suitcase, I rack my brain. Bought a ticket on the late night train. Took a taxi through the pouring rain. I'm coming home to you.
I love the image of Robert Earl Keen back at home in Texas, going through the treasures he's collected in his career. I'm imagining stuff like old concert posters, lyrics scribbled on napkins, backstage passes, photos of fans and fellow musicians, a scrapbook of a life spent on the road. There's nothing better for a fan than to have one of your favorite artists play a show in your town. Robert Earl Keen did just that for 40 years, and he thrilled millions of fans along the way. But as he said in our interview, it can be hard on a body and a soul. There's this odd balance in creative work. Most of it starts in a quiet place, sometimes a little room like Robert's scriptorium. But then it sometimes ends up blasted out to the world through records or concerts or whatever. It takes a lot to thrive in both those places. And I can see why, after a lifetime of striking that balance, that someone would long for home. It turns out that Robert Earl Keen has got a song for that too.
I said I'm coming home to you. I'm coming home. Made up my mind, that's what I'm gonna do. Can't love nobody on the telephone. I'm coming home to you.
Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where every episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.